You're listening to episode 18 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this episode, we talk with RPG designer Ken Hite. Running time for this episode is 57 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
My name is John.
This is Chris.
And joining us today is Ken Hite.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Ken, we got a couple things we want to cover here announcement-wise, and apparently Wayne has some kind of a surprise for us. I don't know what's going on here. But before we get to that, I do want to at least kind of get the audience in on the discussion here. So would you mind giving us just a bit of a resume of who you are, where you've been, what you've done, just so people can kind of put some context with the name?
Oh, that's cool. I'm Kenneth Hite. I've been writing role-playing game stuff since the mid-90s. A lot of GURPS material, GURPS Cabal, GURPS Horror, two editions of it now, GURPS Infinite Worlds. I've done a bunch of stuff for Star Trek role-playing games for both Last Unicorn and Decipher. I've written for White Wolf, both old and new World of Darkness. I've most recently, I'm the creator of the Day After Ragnarok setting for Savage Worlds and Hero, and the designer of Trail of Cthulhu for Pelgrane Press, and I've written a number of supplements and source books for that. So that's, in a nutshell, me.
Now, I have a whole bunch of questions for you and also a game that Ryan Dancy wanted us to play with you, but we're going to come back to that. I've got two announcements here real quick, the first of which is the night prior to this recording, I did an episode with This Just In from Gen Con where we did a post-mortem on the convention, on the podcast, on a whole bunch of stuff. Talked about a lot of great stuff. I will link that in the show notes so anyone who's interested can go and check that out. The second thing is I want to remind you guys real quick, we are still doing the video game giveaway. So if you've not already, go out to the link that's in the show notes and enter there. And be sure to check off which games you're interested in. Those games will all be listed out there along with links to kind of explain what the games are, you know, give you a little bit of marketing material on what you're entering for. But that's, once again, completely free giveaway. So just go out there. And if you're interested in those games, get yourself entered. All right. So, Wayne, what is it you have?
I have first a note here for you. This gift is presented to Dan of Fear the Boot for outstanding qualities of honor, duty, selflessness, and being an overall awesome guy. Keep on rocking, Brian, a.k.a. Parapet. Normally, I would wait for a regular episode. A listener has mailed this to you.
Okay.
I have no idea what this is, and I am dying to find out what he sent you.
I don't either. It's wrapped in very nice silver wrapping paper.
It is.
Yeah.
I can tell you about it. It's a, rectangular box about the size of a cologne box. I don't It's not got the weight of cologne, and that'd be really weird. If you send me Aqua Digia, that's just creepy, by the way. Oh, badass. It's a, well, hold on. There's a couple, or is that just packing? That's packing. Okay, there's paper in here as well. No, badass. It's a chainmail dice bag. It's made of a really fine chain. This is not like large rings. I mean, these rings are probably, I mean, it looked to be any more about, what, maybe an eighth of an inch across, you think, Pat? Somewhere in that? I mean, this is a really fine chain.
That is some real fine craftsmanship.
Yeah, and there's a D20 in there as well, an orange and black D20. Well, thank you very much, sir. I really appreciate it. It was really nice of you to send that our way, and this is pretty awesome. This is going to become my dice bag throughout BattleTech.
World's best nut sack.
Pretty
protector.
Sexy. That even feels fine, almost soft.
Alrighty, so Ken, let's start with this. There's a question I got to ask you. You have a degree in
2 degrees
in something that, you know, you work in games, which I presume, therefore, if you have a degree, it's either going to be in liberal arts or, you know, maybe you are a tech guy because, hey, everybody who's a tech guy also games, right?
Right.
But your degree's neither. How did you end up with this degree? What was the motivation? And how did you go from these degrees to being a game designer?
What are they?
Yeah, I guess we'll start with that. For the audience's sake, what are these degrees?
Well, I've got a bachelor's degree in cartography, which I got because I really liked maps, and I thought that would be a pretty great job to make maps. And after 4 years of college studying cartography, I realized that making maps was hard and involved a lot of math and was not such a great job. So after kicking around Oklahoma City, which is where I grew up, I went to graduate school in Chicago at the University of Chicago because I'd taken a minor in undergraduate in political science. So I got a master's degree in international relations. again, just sort of exploring the academic side of international relations, security studies, stuff like that, thinking vaguely about a foreign service career. Well, I cleverly timed my master's degree in international relations for the end of the Cold War. So the amount of hiring in that field was down. The first President Bush's recession tapped right around then. And by then, I'd kind of fallen in love with Chicago anyway, and I didn't really fancy moving to Washington, D.C. or anywhere else, or New York or wherever, to perhaps try and put my degree to productive use. So I just hung around Chicago. I wrote things with people I went to the university with. My co-authors on the two GURPS Alternate Earths books were both history majors at U of C. Over the years, you know, did the same sort of scut work that everyone does. You know, I worked for a health insurance company for a while doing cartographic data systems, which is just as exciting as it sounds. And then by the time I'd written enough stuff that my writing income looked like it could keep me, you know, fed and maybe even keep the rent paid, I quit the health insurance job and went into writing full time pretty much. And that's the glorious story of my success.
So I'm curious, even if you never actually use the degree for its intended purpose, has your background in cartography and international relations affected your game writing or your setting design? Or
well, I think that the IR degree had a concentration in international history, and I think that that sort of big picture look at historical processes helps when you're building a game world. I mean, I think that certainly explains a good part of Alternate Earths and the Infinite Worlds stuff, that sort of what if history had gone a different way. You don't necessarily need a master's degree to write that stuff, certainly, but I had one and it didn't hurt. I think that something like Day After Ragnarok with a strong international tension type storyline going on, I think it benefits somewhat, and I was able to at least know what the map ought to look like in the middle, even though I made Hal draw it.
Let's start with a little bit of recent history here. Now, you were at Gen Con 2011, right?
Yeah, I've been at every Gen Con except for the 1 year that I was at RopeCon in Finland.
Yeah, I was pretty sure you were there because at one point Shane from ArcDream was going to take me over to introduce me to you, but when we went over there, you were not around. So here's the thing I want to ask you, because this is something that we kicked around with Ryan Dancy, and I also just kicked around with Daniel and Rich over on This Just In. Whether it was influenced by Gen Con or just influenced by recent experiences in general, what do you think the current state of the RPG industry is?
Well, I think that you have to separate that more than ever between the state of the industry as a art form or a design field and the state of the industry as a financial sector.
Yes, I absolutely agree.
I think that as the state of the industry as a financial sector is that we are beginning to maybe bounce off the bottom of the canyon that we fell into, starting with the collapse of the D20 bubble, certainly. And I think that with sort of the maturation of the PDF market and the myriad different ways to go direct to the customer, start cutting out some of the useless distribution channel and focus on producing things to an audience that's already primed to buy it, I think you're beginning to see a slow creep up for it as an economic model. It's never going to get back to where it was in 1980. That's just ridiculous. It'll never be there. But I think that it's less parlous than it looked like in the middle of this decade. So on that level, that's where we are. As a design field, I think it's in, you know, what I've called a mini golden age that I think is kicked off by, say, Sorcerer and My Life with Master and Kill Puppies for Satan, you know, the beginning of the for lack of a better term, the indie resurgence or the indie field and the opening of the doors that basically no barrier to entry has created. So there are more good games to play now than there ever have been. Not least because so many of the old classics are still kicking around in one form or another.
Are you seeing a trend in the type of games that are coming out? Because I've noticed a lot of the indie games seem to be based on a single playthrough or just like a one-shot versus a long-term campaign.
I think a lot of indie games privilege story and narrative over what, you know, classically role-playing games have privileged, which is an exotic setting off of which you bounce in the course of having your adventures, whatever they happen to be. So if you're trying to play the story of a boxer's rise to contendership and then his collapse, that's one story arc, and you can't really have a campaign of that. You know, even Mike Tyson can't have a campaign of that, much less make a satisfying game out of it. So I think that you're seeing the role-playing form used to tell a different catalog or category of stories. A lot of those, yeah, they reward one-shot player there, or they're prescriptively about a certain story outcome as opposed to exploration or an attempt to find out what would happen if you were given plus five sword in the door to a dungeon.
Do you think that's actually a good thing, really, or is it a bad thing? Yeah, short stories are nice and fun to read, but you know, lots of people do like longer novels. I mean, I agree that it does seem to be kind of trending that way, but is that really a good thing? Or is just a thing?
I think it's a thing. I mean, it's a good thing in that it provides role-playing outlets for those kinds of stories, which we didn't really have much of. I mean, the closest thing you got to dramatic arcs in role-playing games was Pendragon, where you would deliberately play your character to a certain point, and then he would get old and die, and you'd start playing his son and go on the next batch of adventures. You really didn't have any sort of satisfying drama, you know, as understood by, say, you know, Aristotle or anybody else. So the fact that those stories are now open to role-playing, I think, is an unalloyed good. And it's not as though, you know, old-fashioned setting exploration, sandbox, whatever you want to call it, role-playing has gone anywhere. Obviously, you've got Dungeons & Dragons, you've got a brand new version of Warhammer, you've got Eclipse Phase, you've got many, 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 whatever you want to call it, conventional or simulationist-type role-playing games out there. So by expanding the market, I think that, or by expanding at least the nature of the kinds of stories you can tell, I think it's pretty much a solidly good thing. And the fact that a lot of those games have used mechanics and have used design techniques that have really gone back and informed other sorts of role-playing games, again, I think that that's really fertilized and nurtured creatively the industry, even in the sort of most familiar sword-swinging, orc-killing type role-playing games.
There's something I've observed about gamers in general, which is I think there's an epiphany that most role players have pretty quickly within their role playing career, which is there aren't many of us. We know from the get-go that our hobby is a relatively small niche sort of hobby. And I think as a result, we tend to, I think, quite frankly, take too seriously the fads of the moment. Right now, you know, we are in a fad of what's coming out as a lot of indie story-based one-shot games. Prior to this, we went through a fad of D20. You know, prior to that, we keep on going back and going back and going back all the way to the start of role-playing games, you know, back in the exactly where you want to peg, it's up to you, with 70s, 60s, whatever. And, you know, as I talk to people coming off of Gen Con, and I listen to the people try and guess where the hobby is right now, which I think is certainly an interesting academic conversation to have, I really think that a lot of role players mistake fads for long-term trends. Where we are at now is a sign of where the future will forever be.
I think that's true in anything. I mean, that's true whether you're in a small field like role-playing or a huge field like economics. I mean, the number of people who predicted during the last boom that, you know, booms are going to go on forever. We've broken the business cycle. We'll never have another recession. You have the same, you know, almost the exact same people predicting that we've obviously slipped into a structural recession and we're going to have the second coming of the 1970s and it's going to be stagflation until the end of time. This is just standard intellectual habit. I mean, people predicted that the Middle East would look exactly the way it's looked since 1948 until all of a sudden it doesn't. And they predicted that, you know, back when I was getting my entirely useful international relations degree, that the Soviet Union was a stable state and that we'd be basically in an atomic bipolar world for, you know, the foreseeable future, which of course...
You beat me to the joke.
it didn't even last out my degree, much less the lifetime of the Soviet state. So it's a habit that I think everybody has. And we project from our current circumstances in role-playing game hobbyism. I think that to an extent, people overvalue things that have got, you know, internet buzz or are being played by people that they see on RPGNet or the buddies that they meet at conventions. And they forget that overwhelmingly, by the numbers, this is a Dungeons & Dragons hobby and everyone else, with the possible exception of vampires, a rounding error. And that's been true since 1974.
And now, would you still hold that true, though, with Pathfinder?
I would say that Pathfinder is basically Dungeons & Dragons the way people wanted to play Dungeons & Dragons. I mean, I think that certainly... You know, if you asked anyone who was not one of us to go through and figure out the difference between a Pathfinder game and a D&D game, they couldn't do it.
Fair point. I was just curious how you would deal with them, but phrased that way, I do agree with you. I mean, obviously, Pathfinder really is the continuation.
3.75.
Yeah, it's 3.75. I mean,
it's like if George Lucas laid down the original trilogy and said, you guys can do anything you want with those movies as long as you don't call them Star Wars. And so you and me got a couple of bucks together and set up Luke and Han, the trilogy, obviously it would still be Star Wars.
Actually, I would totally just make a sequel to Hardware Wars, but by even I'm terribly dating myself.
That would be amazing.
Chris, thank you. I'm glad everybody.
Oh, you're kidding? I loved Hardware Wars. Ham Salad, Fluke Starbucker, Augie Ben Doggy. You can't beat that movie. That was probably one of the best parodies ever done, and it was done in an age when it was difficult to do those kinds of parodies because it just you didn't have the gear to make it easy. And it's hilarious. It's really well.
Basketball is a peaceful planet.
You didn't have like YouTube or anything to float it around on. I'm going to see if I can track that one down.
It was phenomenal. The whole line about the whole martyr part of it, when Augie Ben Doggy sacrifices himself, and they're like, all right, fine, whatever, you martyr. You know, and they all get all mad at him because he's going to get himself killed.
And we've lost everybody.
Old people are laughing at things. I'm still trying to write out the plot of Salacious Crumb, X-Wing Ace, wishing that Star Wars was open source.
All right, so Ken, I am curious, because you got your start really mostly with GURPS.
Yeah, GURPS and Nephilim. Yeah,
yeah, so I was not familiar with GURPS, you know, it's the generic universal role-playing system. I mean, it's effectively a Megaverse rule system, really without any explicit setting to it. I suppose it's kind of like what Palladium tried to do, except there was no real pretense of even it, per se, having a setting. And you moved from that into the things you're doing now. I don't want to say they're narrowly focused, but they're certainly more narrowly focused than GURPS is. And if we talk about the current fads of the industry, certainly what's being published as a whole, the current fad, is away from things like GURPS and over to games that are a little bit quicker to take and maybe even a little bit more disposable from a product sense. And I'm curious how that has impacted you, or I mean, has that really figured into your thinking or affected your career?
Well, I mean, my career, just to use the term loosely, basically it's, you know, I write what people pay me to write. And Steve Jackson has always paid me to write GURPS. The revision for GURPS Horror 4th edition just came out a week or two ago.
So did Steve seek you out way back when, or did you seek him out, or how did you get started in GURPS?
Steve used to, and still does actually, have a thing on his website, although this was before websites. It was a thing in his magazines, as the man says, are kind of papery blogs for people who don't know, that said, if you want to write for Steve Jackson Games, here's what you do. And you write down, you know, your outline, and you send a sample chapter off, and you print it out on physical paper, and you ship it off to Steve. And so my buddies and I wrote the outline and a chapter or two of what became GURPS Alternate Earths and sent it off to Steve. And I would come up to Gen Con and talk to Steve about it. And after I don't know how many years of me nagging him, he read the submission and liked it and commissioned Alternate Earths and then the sequel. And then Infinite Worlds. And so I basically started writing Alternate Earths right at the same time that they launched in Nomine. And so they needed some people who could write to fill out the content on that line. So I wrote parts of, I think, three books for Nomine. And it was basically just a matter of Steve was the person who was the most professional about offering people jobs and paying them when they did them. And to a remarkably large extent, that's still true. I mean, I don't know how many professional game designers you guys have talked to, but to never have been owed a nickel by somebody is very rare, and I have never been owed a nickel by Steve Jackson. So,
yeah, that's something I've heard many, many times.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Even going way back when, while I never made as far as you did in the writing thing, my first foray into role-playing games, quote-unquote professionally, we were my brother and I, we were co-writing columns for MechForce North America, the official Battletech fan magazine, and then were being transitioned over to write stuff for FOSS itself, right when they went bankrupt, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is about like getting an international affairs degree right at the end of the Cold War.
Oh, it's not just that. I mean, I've hired two people on Goblins, and one of them has been personally screwed after completing maps for a very, by a very big, a recognizable, you know, top five game.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you right now, I've been screwed over. Now, in my case, it was not what I needed to live on. I was in high school at the time. I mean, this was just, you know, stupid money. But yeah, there's no end to the people I know who have been screwed. And I will say that, I mean, that is one of the things that I think is a real stunting problem with the role-playing industry, a lack of professionalism on every side. That because of the fact that most people, if not every person, gets into this first because it's a hobby and then second as a career, they don't bring a career mindset to it. I mean, when I go to a job, I like my job. I don't love my job. It's not what I would do with my free time if I was independently wealthy. But I go in there with a certain mindset that there are things I'm paid to do and I'm going to get them done. And they, in turn, have an understanding they're going to pay me, or I'm going to be calling up the Department of Justice to go after them on my behalf. And I look at the RPG industry, and on one hand, I talk to a lot of people who have done the writing, done the art, done the layout, have gotten screwed, gotten burned, and as a result, gotten very cynical, dropped out completely. Their production goes downhill, whatever the case may be, which shows an absolute lack of professionalism on behalf of the publishers, who do not treat these people like employees that are owed money for their work. And on the flip side, I've also seen a whole lot of people who get into this wanting to write something or draw something and take an extremely cavalier attitude. And despite having been given the promise of a paycheck, a contract, maybe even some earnest money up front, never bother to follow through and deliver on any of that. And I've been screwed on that side as well, where I have paid artists in particular for work I have never seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that can't say that that's not a accurate statement. I mean, it's a hobby slash industry in the best and the worst senses of those terms. People get into it and they produce reams and reams and reams of material for it because they love the hobby and they love the exercise of playing in these various sandboxes. And people graduate to being full-blown publishers from the same motivations. And there just isn't the level of cash flow that would keep people honest, and there's not the barriers of entry that force you to be good at anything before you start a role-playing game company or start being a role-playing game writer.
Indeed.
It's just the way of the world, right?
So I'm kind of curious, these early settings that you brought to Steve Jackson, were these something you were creating right then and there, or was this a homebrew setting you were playing with your gaming group?
The GURPS Alternate Earth stuff, one of them came out of a Champions game that one of my co-authors ran. And the three of us sort of collaboratively designed the setting. It was actually the setting of one adventure. And they visited that world for about 10 minutes, I think, before they defeated the bad guys and left it again. But we'd done all the design work. So we decided to finish it out and present it as a setting in GURPS, Alternate Earths. I think it wound up in Alternate Earths, too, by the time we were done. Others were just your very standard, the Confederates win the Civil War, the Nazis win World War II, that kind of thing. Part of it was just made up or boiled down from the general consensus vision of the universe. And part of it was stuff that showed up. And then once I started running games at Chicago, I ran a lot of alternate history games. So some of them, the settings that I sort of presented in that game made their way one way or the other into Alternate Earth. Gernsback, for example, was a setting of a partial campaign that I ran that was pretty good, I thought. And it's very much the science fictional world of the future. And then the attempt to rationalize why a world would actually grow up that way was the, you know, for lack of a better term, the rigor that I brought to it. Again, in Alternate Earths, Ezcali, the Aztecs win alternate was something that Steve said he wanted because they had GURPS Aztecs coming out. And I think Steve likes Aztecs. And the fact that the world makes almost literally zero historical sense because there's no way that would happen is, you know, just a happy side effect, I guess.
Ken, I have a question for you. Are you currently in any games right now that you're playing either with friends or running anything?
Yeah, I'm running Nobilis Second Edition right now. I've been playing with my gaming group, running for them every Monday pretty much since I moved to Chicago. So for years and years and years, the people have moved on or gone to other cities or, you know, moved out of the neighborhood or they've had kids or whatever it is that's kept them away. But the group continues much like Achilles' ship.
Is this an ongoing thing where characters pop in and out, or are you like, you know, starting up new campaigns every, you know, so often?
I start up new campaigns every so often. Right before Nobilis was the playtest for Knights Black Agents. And after Nobilis, we'll probably be doing some Savage Worlds. Although that's nothing is certain until the players decide what we're going
to
do.
I have one more follow-up with this one, because this one's important to me. GM screen, yes, no?
I don't use one for Nobilis, because what would be the point? I don't think I've actually used a GM screen since the old, old, old days when I was running D&D in the high school cafeteria and whatnot.
You are a wise man, but right now, while Chris is on the ground, I want you to kick him a few times. Why don't you use one?
That was my next question. I'm just curious.
Well, I mean, I would use one if it seemed like it was necessary, or if I didn't basically have all the tables, you know, in some other place to look them up. I mean, using a GM screen pretty much is just the place you keep the speed range table or the THACO chart or whatever it happens to be. It's not so much a, you know, hide the dice, because I guess part of it is because I ran so much Call of Cthulhu that there's really no way to croc that game in the GM's favor. It pretty much comes pre-crocked. So there's no reason for me to hide the dice in a game like that, and I just never got into the habit afterwards.
Oh, you would use it to croc it against the players. See, when I hide rolls, I usually croc it for them because they've fallen over and tripped on something and broken their neck.
Yeah.
But I'm tempted to sometimes.
Yeah, once again, in Call of Cthulhu, every time they survive, they always assume I crocked the dice in their favor. So,
yeah, big whoop.
But I don't really have a philosophical dog in that fight. I mean, if people want to use GM screens, that's one, you know, iteration of the hobby. I, again, playing whatever it was, 7 years of Call of Cthulhu, pretty much rewrote my game mastering DNA, I think. And so I still fall back on all those old habits.
Well, that's kind of where I was going with that, is really what kind of, when you said, you know, unless it's necessary, you seem to then go on and define for you what is what necessary means, if you need access to tables and whatnot. But you don't really use it as a means with which to, you know, the whole man behind the curtain kind of thing, and keeping, yeah, you know, keep
to hide himself, to create implied social distance between himself and players, to have some kind of insecure sign of his throne above men. is that what we're talking about, Chris? You didn't mention any of that?
That's not really what I was referring to, but if it makes you feel better to say that, that's fine.
I mean, again, for whatever reason, I've never felt that having a screen or not having a screen would make it any less or more likely that I get to have my way as the GM. So if I need to, bear down on something, I can do it with or without a screen. So there's no real point.
Sure.
Maybe we should drag him into all of our fights. So do you make people roll for social skills or just have them role play it out and go with that?
Actually, I do think you should drag him into all of our fights. I think these are good questions, because honestly, this is...
Ken Heist going to be like our marriage counselor.
I think with something like that, it's very much...
And Ken, before you answer, let me just say my reasoning for wanting to ask you what are seemingly mundane questions. And I think that when it comes to people who are in the industry, you know, your rank and file players, you know, or as we like to refer to them, you know, behind the scenes, the great unwashed, I think that they like
Chris
to know.
Chris@feartheboot.com.
Yeah. Behind what scenes?
Actually, that term came from Chad, really. I'm just borrowing his term since he's not here to defend himself.
That's
but
fair.
I think that there's an interest in knowing exactly, you know, well, yeah, okay, you're busy writing games and you're busy doing all of these other things, you know, in that side of the industry. What is it like when you play your games? Those kinds of things. And so I think that these actually are in some ways relevant questions. I know that I'm actually interested to hear, because I think it also gives a little bit of perspective as to you as a person and your approach to how you design.
Well, I mean, right now I'm running Nobilis, like I say, so no one rolls for anything. I think if the game's got strong dice-based mechanics for social interaction, use those mechanics. They were designed for a reason. I'm generally a fan of having a mechanical backstop for anything that you think is important in play. Yeah, if you've got a good set of social combat or social engineering or social whatever you want to call it rules, I'd say knock yourself out. Go ahead and use them. Again, Gumshoe generally doesn't roll for social rules, because the use of a social skill is to get information in a scene. If you were playing a game of repartee and innuendo at the court of Charles II, you'd have nothing but social mechanics, perhaps. And you'd have to use them, because that would be the whole point of the game. Certainly when I was doing my HeroQuest game, set in the 1760s in London, there was a great deal of social mechanics. You know, how impressive were you at the ball? Did you get Horace Walpole to talk to you at the soiree, whatever it happens to be, right?
Do you tend to write games and play them the same way? Or do you tend to write games differently because you know you're writing to a specific existent structure? Or is there a disconnect there where one is hobby and one is more job?
A lot of it depends on the property. I mean, for Trail of Cthulhu, I'm very much writing games that I want to play. I wrote Bookhounds of London because that's basically how I run any urban setting, certainly any contemporary urban setting. Everything in Bookhounds of London is how I would run London, or how I have run London or Cairo or Chicago, or whatever city it happens to be that the game has taken place in. Some games, for example, the various Star Trek role-playing games, when I was writing for that, I never actually ran any Star Trek games, so I basically wrote toward a sort of an average Star Trek gamer that lived in my head, and it worked on that basis. At this point in my career, I try not to write stuff that I actively don't want to play, stuff that I will just have no interest in, because I think that will communicate itself to the reader. They'll say, oh, you know, Height just wrote this for the ridiculously mediocre paycheck. And again, the money in this field is not good enough for me to have to write something I don't actually care about. And at this point, I can pick and choose jobs enough that I don't have to take a gig for, you know, some, you know, Warhammer 40K, which I'm sure is a fine and wonderful setting, but I have pretty much zero interest in.
So what was the first game you ever played, and what was the first game you ever ran?
The first game I ever played was Dungeons & Dragons, AD&D, and then right around then the basic set as well. We had a collection of D&D gamers. This was back in high school in the 70s. And we'd, you know, just play whatever someone happened to have a dungeon for. And then at one point or another, I was co-DMing with a buddy of mine. I went off to get, you know, a Slurpee at the 7-Eleven or whatever it was. And I came back, and all the players had Vorpal swords and were riding Pegasi. And I looked at Dave, my co-DM, and he just sort of sat there downcast with his eyes pointed at the table. And I said, all right, we're all agreed that the last half hour didn't happen, and you wake up in the dungeon as normal third level players or characters or whatever they were.
You just said, bust out Azure Bonds and go from there.
And they said, okay, that's probably good. I think from that point, I was sort of DM for life. And I ran Dungeons & Dragons all through high school. And then in 1981, when Call of Cthulhu came out, I bought, as I'm fond of saying, the first copy on sale in Oklahoma and ran the heck out of it for 7 years. I've still probably run more Call of Cthulhu than anything else, and I still love it better than any other game. But, you know, the first play and the first run for me were good old D&D back in the day, you know, kick down the door, shoot the orc, take his stuff.
Is there any game you'd love to run for your group, but it's just not a fit for them?
My current collection of players, some of them have been in Call of Cthulhu games that I've run. Others have not because they have Lovecraft allergy. It'd be nice to get to run a real hardcore Lovecraftian horror game again. I haven't done that since, I guess, 2004, 2005, something like that. But there are so many great game ideas, and you're never going to get to run them all. I think I'd like to run a good Lovecraftian game again, but I think I'm going to have to either get a second player group or do something else to be able to do that over a long term. And there's plenty of other stuff to run. Like I say, we've got a backlog.
You not only run, but also, in fact, write a horror game. And my observation about gaming in general, and I think most people agree with this, is the best gaming moments you have are those where the people, you know, at least on some subconscious level, they're not at the table. They're really there in the dramatic moment. You know, they're far more invested in the game world than they are in realizing they're sitting on a couch in a room somewhere. And it seems to me like horror requires that more than any other setting, for the simple reason that science fiction, well, really, it's just about things and places. Fantasy is about things and places. What defines those genres is things and places. Horror is not. Horror is an emotion. Horror could occur in fantasy, sci-fi, modern day, whatever, but it is a setting or genre concept that really is not about places and proper nouns. It's about conveying emotion. And one of the things that I have always struggled with, that I've only managed to pull off well a very small number of times, is running a good horror game simply for lack of a good way of actually making the people at the table buy into the emotion of fear, to make them feel something, even though in truth all they're dealing with is numbers on a piece of paper and dice and Cheetos. And as someone who both writes it and runs it, I'm curious how you've gotten past that, or what kind of tricks you've come up with over the years.
I think the real key to having horror succeed, and I think you're absolutely right that horror depends on a state of mind and a state of emotion more even than fantasy and science fiction, which, again, neither of them really works unless you have a sort of a sense of wonder moment.
Yes.
This is not the boring basement of the dorm room. This is not your den with the big screen TV. This is a starship bridge. This is an elf forest, whatever it happens to be. I think you still have to get that sense of being away from the table for those games to really catch fire too.
Yes, I agree.
But in horror, I think the real secret is you have to get the players to buy into it. And once they've explicitly agreed to do it, I think that you can start building something really productive and really terrifying together. You can start jointly exploring, you know, either tentatively or at full throttle, what it is that actually unnerves you, scares you, terrifies you, upsets you, whatever it happens to be. And really, the only way to get good at it is to have players who you trust and who trust you. And that's something you can either get by sheer luck, or you can get it by training your players that you're not going to screw them in a fantasy or a science fiction or a spy or any other kind of game. And when it comes to a game like Call of Cthulhu, where they're literally sacrificing their characters' lives by the dint of being in the game in the first place, they've made that decision. They've stepped across that threshold. They've made the sacrifice, the buy-in that you need for good horror. Obviously, in GURPS horror, I go into it in, you know, pages and pages and pages of detail, but I think that the core of it is that level of mutual trust and mutual cooperation, that you have to recognize that horror only works if everyone wants it to work. And if one guy is just there, you know, screwing around with the Xbox or eating Cheetos or doing Monty Python, it's going to wreck it for everybody. And you don't play with that guy, or you don't play horror with that guy. That guy, you know, may be a great orc-killing druid, but he's not going to be any help hunting vampires, so leave him home that day.
You know, I'd have to agree with you on that. I've been in a horror campaign that was run successfully once, and that was the secret to it. But the GM obviously had to do a lot of the heavy lifting to make sure that the mood was set properly and that he created the right sense to it. But yeah, it had to have buy-in from everybody at the table, which in this case it did, and it really did. It made a big difference, because I was very skeptical, because I just, you know, like Dan was saying, I find that hard to believe, but when, you know, hard to go get into that level of suspension of disbelief. But when I'm seeing everybody around me do that, it kind of contributes and makes things a little bit easier for me as a player to jump in there.
I think it's an example of where the basic principles of mass hysteria work in your favor. You want to get yourself freaked out, get somebody else with you who's already freaked out. I mean, that kind of thing is contagious. And so, I absolutely agree that this has to be a group effort. I think part of the problem I've had is, I don't know, maybe I take too ham-fisted an approach with it. I'm trying to create scary things rather than allowing the players to simply freak themselves out. I don't know. I mean, Ken, what do you think on that? Have you found it's better to write something that's scary, or simply present them with less scary things but get them in the right state psychologically to where they scare themselves?
I don't think it's an either or. I think that if you're doing your job as the GM, you're bringing them something that's an inherently horrific setup, you know, whether it's a haunted house or life as a vampire, or a world in which, you know, Yog-Sothoth is scrabbling at the edge of the laws of physics waiting to destroy them, whatever it happens to be, you're in that already horrifying situation. And I think your job as the GM is to sort of find the shortest route between the fundamental terror of whatever that is, whether it's vampires or Yog-Sothoth or ghosts, and the actual psychological vulnerabilities that we all as humans have, and shoot it right down into your players' sort of pineal glands before they have a chance to put up any kind of defenses. And since you've got the trust that hopefully involves them lowering their defenses, being willing to play along, knowing that you're not going to take advantage of it or turn it into something weird and pointless, then you can use both the fundamental terror of the setting and their herd instinct, their willingness to terrify each other. Part of it is just recognizing when your players are being creeped out and feed that, whatever it happens to be. I mean, sometimes I've had the players, you know, fixate on some tiny little piece of setting material and just work themselves into a state over it. And the smart play is to know when and how often to cut away or back to that piece of setting material. And again, there's no short form answer except do it a lot and maybe watch other experts do it. Watch horror movies, read horror novels, find out how people in other media get scared and get you to agree to scare yourself. I mean, there's nothing inherently scarier about a book or a movie than there is about a role-playing game. You're still cooperating in your own state of terror.
Watch a horror movie with the lights on, the windows open, and your buddy drinking beers making fun of it. Mm-hmm. Watch the exact same movie by yourself in a dark house in the middle of the night. Obviously, it's a completely different experience.
I have one question going back to an earlier topic. You said you are pretty constantly the GM and have been for decades. Have you played at all in the last years? And if not, do you ever want to?
I've played. A buddy of mine ran a D&D 4th edition game that I played in. We met, it's like once every 3 weeks or whatever it was. And, it was old school, high school style D&D, right?
We
spent all Saturday, just like none of us had wives or girlfriends, you know, kicking down doors and scooping up loot and having immense fights on the graph paper and the whole nine yards. And it was terrific. It was a great experience. I love playing. It's just that there's only so many hours in the day. And since I do actually have a wife and I do actually have writing to do and movies to watch and other stuff, there's only a limited amount of other gaming I can get in. And I do think that it's important as a designer to run games, or more important as a designer to run them than it is to play them, because it's a more analogous endeavor, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Even if it's not something that I'm going to put into another game, I know what works now for five players, which is better than if I'm playing. Then I just kind of know what works for me, and I already know what works for me.
Because, yeah, I basically went through my entire higher education track unable to find another GM in any of my friend circles, and having just come back to St. Louis a month or two ago and hopped into Dan's Battletech game, it's really a breath of fresh air, because
I have
not played at all for years.
Yeah, no, there's really nothing like just getting to be the player, you know.
Yeah.
I got to be an Elven Ranger, which I haven't gotten to be in forever. and just the sheer delight of being the guy who gets to stand 20 hexes back and just nail everyone with longbow shots. That was terrific.
That is a lot of fun. I played a human ranger recently. Same deal.
You said you had 5 players right now?
Yeah, right now.
Okay.
I've had as many as 9 and as few as 3.
I want to ask you a question. If you were to write 4 pages of background material and give it to the 5 players as homework, how many of them would come back to the next game session having read of it?
Your ass, man. He's just trying to bait me right now at the moment. So
he's a good baiter.
Actually, before I started doing this full time and professionally, I used to hand out much thicker handouts to the players. And
did they read them?
I'd hand it out. Some would read it, some wouldn't. I would usually present like a 1 or 2 page summary, and then more stuff would go into more depth. And in
I
some
kiss
case,
you full lips next time I see you, Ken.
Well, wait, hang on. We're not done with this. There's 5 people. This can't be a 50-50 split. Would 3 read it or 3 not read it?
Of the current 5, I would say probably 3 would and 2 wouldn't.
There we go. I have the majority.
I want a different counselor.
No, and I'll just point out that I was gaming last night and I gave 2 1-page and 1 2-page handout to my players, and 1 would read them while the other 2 paid attention and listened. So there you go.
Well, everyone picks up stuff differently, right? And for the HeroQuest game, we did the lexicon system where everyone writes part of the world background. So we all had stuff to read.
I like it when it's their own when they have their own interpretations of what's on the page. I think that is an enhancement to what happens and goes on the table, because it kind of creates a little bit of role play and discussion, and even possibly good-natured arguments about what was really meant by that.
That's the point of gaming instead of writing. I recently had a faction that I drew up to be liberators to one of the oppressed player characters, and he told me after the game, "I hate these guys. They're condescending. I wish they'd go away." And I thought, that's awesome.
Any other ways you want to poke the bear with a stick, Dan?
Yeah, I think, Ken, I've decided whether you like it or not, from this point forward, you're going to be Fear the Boots marriage counselor. Every time we're having a dispute, I'm going to drag you back on here to settle it for us.
Okay. I will not misuse my powers.
Good. You already agreed with Chris once, so you've got some room to grow. But yeah,
in my book right there.
All right. There's something that we got to do here, just because I promised somebody who's not a part of our show that we would do it, which is Ryan Dancy told us that there is a game that we have to play with you, Ken. And here's how the game's going to go, if you're up for it.
Okay.
You said this is not the first game you've played for Ryan. I don't know what that means. I'm probably better off that way, but we'll see how you do it this one.
Those White Wolf parties.
Yeah, those White Wolf parties that used to occur.
Yeah.
I have in front of me a cell phone pulled up to a 1-minute countdown timer.
Okay.
And I have a piece of paper with 3 words on it that I picked by randomly opening a dictionary and pointing to these 3 words.
Okay.
Ryan Dancy said if I gave you these 3 words within 1 minute, you could come up with a plot for me.
Okay.
He has great confidence. You can do this.
Ryan is confident in all things. That's one of his many charms.
You've never heard his predictions for the industry, have you?
I've heard his predictions. He's always confident.
Okay.
He's confident in his own prediction.
Yeah, he's confident in absolute abject failure.
Yeah.
Okay, he's confident. He's just not sunny. But
no,
he was
not always.
He was confident in success here, okay? He was confident that you could do this. All right, so I'm going to give you the 3 words and hit start. We're going to see how you do. All right, here we go.
All right.
Your 3 words are derelict, pointless, and handshake. Go.
Okay. Derelict and handshake. Obviously, the connection there is that there is probably a long chain virus or perhaps an alien contamination that's passed along by skin contact. Handshakes, and it nests or pools or its colony is in populations of the homeless, bums, people like that. And perhaps it's been around for centuries, perhaps it's just fallen to earth in a meteor, whatever it is, but it's why we have this instinctive unwillingness to touch people who come up asking for money.
Yeah, 15 seconds for pointless.
And their goal is, or the entity's goal is to sort of pass itself around through the entire city, the entire country, whatever it happens to be, in order to bring about a fundamental reorganization of human desire to sort of turn it off, because the desire for an accomplishment for a point is anathema to this entity, whether it's a demon or it's Haster, it's an alien being that can't stand a certain emotional frequency, whatever it happens to be.
So the handshakes of derelicts are making our lives pointless.
Are intended to make our life.
This is a fun game.
That is impressive.
That's pretty good.
All right, we're up to Dwarf Deuce again.
A third Andromeda Strain, a third Deus Ex, and a third something completely new and original. I love it.
Yeah. We're going to play this game one more time because I like this game now. I'm just going to call him up. Oh, that's going to get too over the top. Ooh, this is definitely going to be a different sort of game.
You're not using the dictionary? You're using some other website?
Oh, no, I'm using the dictionary.
Oh, no, he has an old-ass, like, yellow to the point of orange dictionary. And he is actually flipping through it at random.
All right, we're going to play this game one more time because I like this game now. All right, we're going to give you one more. So put a minute. Oops, hush up timer. Put a minute back on the clock.
That's
all right.
Element number one, beeping.
Yeah. So here are your new three words.
Okay.
Appear, flute, and tenant. Go.
Tenant?
Tenant, yeah.
Okay. Well, that one's simple. That's I can do that in probably 15 seconds. There is a tenant in a crumbling apartment house somewhere, maybe Paris, maybe New Orleans, wherever it is. They can play the flute. By dint of the music that they create, things appear. And the appearance depends both on the acoustics of the given room that they play in. So if they play in a room where a murder took place, something murderous appears, possibly a ghost, possibly a spirit of carnage. It depends on their emotional state. So people really kind of need to keep this person sweet. But you strongly suspect that all their fluting with the other side of the curtain between life and death has unhinged them, so they're not always stable. They're troublesome. But, of course, as long as they've got their flute, you can't really do anything to sort of shut them down or calm them out. You can't get them into an institution, for example. So it's just going to keep haunting people. Musicologists, ghost hunters, addicts try and move into this building and try and get the person to play the specific tune that they, you know, the first tune that they dance to with their dead wife or whatever it happens to be. It's sort of like Stalker, where the flute is the zone and or the apartment building is the zone, and the flute is the mechanism by which they imagine that their dreams and desires will be brought into existence. But, of course, just like in Stalker, 9 times out of 10, their actual desire is something unpleasant.
Yep. Solaris.
I think what amazes me so much about this game is that the actual connections seem to come to you very quickly. It's the amount of detail and how quickly you're able to flesh out the entire backstory of everything you're describing to us.
Well, first of all, Dancy was not wrong. You're good at this game. I gotta say, there's this competition called Iron GM, which we are not directly affiliated with. Though Ed Healy, who's one of the guys that runs it, is a friend of the show. If you've not entered that, you should, just for the sake of winning whatever it is they're offering.
Yeah. It's this game, but you run a 6-hour game based on the three words instead of a 1-minute plot synopsis.
I gotta say, Dancy's confidence was not misplaced. You are very good at this game. And I also gotta say that, like Wayne, I'm impressed not just with the fact that you're able to connect them, but the amount of story you were writing. And I stopped the timer because on each one, you clearly had the three words connected within the minute.
Mm-hmm.
But you are still adding detail that I found fascinating. I didn't want it beeping and stopping you, so I'm stopping the timer.
Yeah, I was imagining Guy plays the flute in the insane asylum they put him in, and what happens then?
Yeah, but you know what? In both of those, something else I noticed is in both cases, you went after psychological horror.
Yeah, that's...
came very naturally to you.
I think it's an easy genre to do in sort of contemporary settings. So I think that that's the natural, plus it's probably, you know, it's where my natural reflexes go.
Let me rephrase your words there to say it's easy for you. given those three words, I probably would have been able to come up with a plot. It would not have been psychological horror. And this is why I don't think I'm any good at running horror games.
Yeah. Well, again, a lot of it is just that's what I marinate myself in. I mean, I read horror. I watch horror. I'm a horror aficionado. Yeah, that's my go-to. And again, I mean, derelict, pointless, and handshake, you know, good luck turning that into a fantasy setting.
Well, actually, where I was would have gone with that is with pointless handshake would have been a diplomatic gesture that was ultimately empty because one party was setting the other up.
I was going to go with a derelict spaceship where everyone on board has died a pointless death.
How are you going to get a handshake out of that?
It's the sweat disease. It's,
it's
the old
sweat disease.
Naked time.
Yeah, and then again in Next Generation, they brought it up again there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so having worked through that and having made you get between Chris and I on a few things, actually Chris and Chad on a few things, he's just not here, so I had to take his side. There is something that I want to do here as we close the show out, which is I want to hear about the things you are currently working on or the things you've got coming up, the stuff that you want to get people excited about and tapped into so you know they can check out the stuff that Ken Height is doing here right now and in the upcoming weeks, months, and years.
Okay, the sort of the focus of that, of what I'm writing, you know, the final bits of right now, what's going to hopefully be coming out the next big ticket thing for me is Knight's Black Agents, my vampire spy thriller from Pelgrane Press using the gumshoe system in the thriller mode instead of in the sort of subtle procedural mode. The sort of the high concept for this game is think of the Bourne trilogy if Treadstone were vampires. So you play spies, secret agents, deniable assets. You've left the agency for whatever reason. You've sort of been kicking around Europe doing odd jobs. You're like the guys in the Frankenheimer movie, Ronin. And then you discover that vampires exist. And you know that they exist. They know that you know that they exist. So you have to hunt and kill them before they hunt and kill you.
Wow. So it's like Bourne meets The Boys meets Dresden Files.
Meets Hunters Hunted.
Yeah.
There's a strong aspect of that. Or you could do, you know, The Losers meets Ultraviolet. Or you could go all kinds of different ways. I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities with it while staying within the good old, you know, spy thriller genre.
Or you could do Boysenberry Dowager Moth.
is that an anime? I'm not familiar with that title. Yeah.
Super Robot Boysenberry, go!
No, actually, that was just the first three words I grabbed out of the dictionary. Out of the dictionary. I was baiting you again. I'm sorry, go on.
It's sort of my take on the spy genre. The vampires in it are modular, so the GM builds them, the director builds them. So even if you go into the game knowing you're going to be fighting vampires, you don't know if they're going to be vulnerable to silver or to holy water. You don't know if they show up in mirrors. You don't know even if they drink blood. You don't know if they are, you know, Transylvanian counts or alien beings that fell to Earth from Mars or hyperdimensional entities or guys with some sort of mutant virus in them. It could be any of that. It could be none of that. It could be all of that. So the vampire, the GM builds the vampires. The GM builds the conspiracy, similarly modularly. So it's a genuine job of problem solving, of mystery solving on the part of the players, as opposed to just, you know, flip to the back, you look up the vampire, you solve the problem.
Star Trek, you're... No, this is not another free association. I was actually going to ask...
Did I nod off and we missed a minute or two?
No. This is one of my very crafty segues.
Okay, right.
There was nothing harsh about that at all. No, actually...
He edits a lot.
Yeah. What's funny is those are parts they don't have to edit. I'm actually curious about the approach that you're taking on the Star Trek game you've been working on because of the fact that there have been several iterations of Star Trek RPGs. The first one that I'm familiar with was one that was done by FASA back in the, you know, very early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
There really have not been any that I have looked through in detail, but I'm going to admit, though, I've not looked through the one that you've worked on. But there have been several iterations I've worked through where one of the things that I found a little bit disappointing was I thought FASA did a pretty good job of bringing the whole package of Star Trek together, from working through the character's history to fleshing out the skills sort of in the steps of their lives to getting on a ship and the fact that this your personal skills figured in very directly to ship combat and so on and so forth. And I'm curious what sort of rule structure approach that you took to try and capture the feel of Star Trek in the stuff that you've been doing.
Well, this is stuff that I did, you know, by now 10 years ago. Last Unicorn had the Star Trek license, and then when we got bought by Wizards of the Coast, the license did not transfer because the contract that gave us the license didn't hold for third-party transfers. So Decipher picked up the license to go with their Star Trek card game, and then when we were let go from Wizards of the Coast in one of the Knights of Long Knives that they used to have as their observation of the holiday season.
Order 66.
Right. We all got picked up by Decipher pretty much intact and became the Decipher design unit for the Star Trek game. So we designed two Star Trek games almost literally back to back, and then I left Decipher in, I want to say 2004. It was either 04 or 03, and then went to work for Steve Jackson for about a year as a staff writer. That's how long ago we're talking. This is before it was before Enterprise finished out, in fact.
Oh, wow.
Because, because I remember the joy with which I deleted Enterprise off my TiVo because I no longer professionally had to watch it. And it's before J.J. Abrams did the reboot in the new movie. So I am at least one iteration and possibly two iterations of Star Trek behind Star Trek. But the first one, the Last Unicorn one, we basically took the FASA model. I mean, we used the FASA Life Path model, almost, you know, torn screaming out of that game in our Last Unicorn Star Trek game. We had one book for each series, so we had a different feel in each book for each series. It was Dice Six system. It was exploding sixes. It gave possibilities of very dramatic outcomes, that kind of thing. And since we had a Dice Six range, it pushed the range of characters down so that every given character could afford to be really competent at something to begin with.
What were the different feels between the different series for your game? You said there was a different feel for each of the series.
Yeah, the Next Generation feel was more sort of problem solving. I don't say bureaucratic, but it was much more sort of, here's the situation, and we should all sort of think it out, solve it like grown-ups in a living room. And then my game, the game that I was the developer of, the original series game, was very much a rambunctious, go ahead and shoot it type Star Trek. And Steve Long's Deep Space Nine game was very much, it was the first game where you didn't necessarily have to be Federation personnel. You could just be any kind of a thing, you know, conspiring and manipulating each other there on DS9. We sort of really tried to give the game, to the extent we could, given that it was the identical rule system, a spin for each of those three series core books. Then when we did the Decipher version, it was all Star Trek all the time for the core books. So it was basically a system where you played anything in the Star Trek universe doing anything. So it was wider open. This was after D20 had debuted, and Decipher felt that we should produce a game that was reminiscent of D20 in terms of its play feel. So we went around and designed a system that was much more like that, with feats and various incremental modifiers to make yourself awesome. It still had a life path in it. It lost some of that that old sort of FASA feel that we had in the first iteration, but it gained, I think, a degree of scope that the other games didn't have. And we'd already done one game, so we were at least mechanically better at putting together game books and game engines, I think. I think they're both actually pretty good games. They just play differently enough that they're demonstrably different games set in the Star Trek universe.
Well, Ken, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been a great interview, and I've really had a good time talking to you and making you settle Chris and I's marital disputes. For anyone who's listening, be sure to check the show notes. As always, we'll link to a bunch of stuff. I will also link to some of Ken's work, so if you're interested in checking out what Mr. Height is up to right now and what he's been up to over, you know, the past couple of years, we'll give you stuff on all of that. As for my host here, thank you guys, as always, for joining me here. Everyone out there, you guys have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.